Welcome to Life Sciences and Science Life, a science podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional and Sport Sciences.
Our team of PhD candidates, along with various experts in the field, talk about current advances in science while exploring the challenges and triumphs of PhD life. Welcome to another episode of Life Sciences and Science Life. In today's episode, we're diving into the fascinating topic of healthy aging.
I'm Agnes from the Nutritional Science Department.
And I'm Sarah from the Pharmacognosy Department of the University of Vienna.
As you might know, the average life expectancy has risen impressively to 84 years, which was compared to 100 years ago, only 45 years. And this is why we want to talk a little bit more in detail about healthy aging.
Yes, today Agnes will explore why is protein and vitamin D important for older adults. I will also talk a little bit about my research topic, which focuses on the protein NRF2, which is a main regulator of the antioxidant defense system. So Agnes, as life expectancy rises and we age, what are the main challenges faced by older individuals in today's societies?
Yeah, older persons are confronted with several challenges. For example, although they have gained some additional years in life, they always, or very often, frequently face diminished quality of life due to diseases that might be preventable, such as cardiovascular diseases, obesity, but also osteoporosis or sarcopenia, which is the age-related loss of muscle mass. And because there are several changes in the physiology of older adults, although the weight remains the same, the body composition changes. For example, there is an increased fat mass, and the lean body mass, which encompasses organs and muscles, decrease by approximately 5% every decade after the age of 30. And this is also associated with the loss of muscle mass. And the loss of muscle mass is correlates with reduced mobility and the increased risk for falls and fractures in older adults.
Yeah, that's very common. I see what you mean. And how does this exactly connect to your research?
Well, my research is about actually about how certain nutrients such as vitamin D or protein might improve health outcomes in older adults. And we were not just looking into those nutrients, but we were also doing some human intervention trials where those older adults who were not physically active before started to do guided strength training. And we were investigating physical activity parameters, but also specific blood parameters in our labs, parameters that are related to oxidative stress and also DNA damage. And for these studies, for these two studies, we did one with protein and one with vitamin D. We've recruited at least 100 older adults aged between 65 and 85 years. And we conducted these intervention studies with them. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about your project and its relevance related to aging?
Yeah, of course. I work on a project that is based on the fact that our cells are subjected to various stressors from internal and external factors. What does that mean? That it comes from everywhere, not only from our lifestyles, but mainly from our lifestyles, obviously, but also from the environment that we have around. So the contamination, the UV light, and so on and so forth, and our lifestyles. So all of these stressors comes from internal and external sources. But fortunately for us, there are mechanisms in place that defend the cells against these stresses. In our small lab, we mainly study the interaction between two proteins in our body, NRF2 and AMPK. Both proteins are regulated against stress in our cells. NRF2 regulates oxidative stress, whereas AMPK regulates metabolic stress.
But Sarah, you've mentioned oxidative stress, so what is that exactly?
Well, oxidative stress, it's based on the phenomenon caused by an imbalance between the production and accumulation of oxygen-reactive species, better known as ROS, in cells and tissues, and the ability of a biological system to detoxify this reactive product. So, in general, these reactive oxygen species that come from internal and external sources, will stress our cells. However, our cells have mechanisms in which they will, let's call it, detoxify these insults in a way that it doesn't damage our cells or tissues.
So, Sarah, I'm familiar with this topic, so it's easier for me to follow. But how would you explain this to people who are not familiar with this research?
So, NRF2 gets active when we have either an activator or we have oxidative stress in our bodies. So it can come from UV light, for instance, or it can come from the fact that we smoke or from the dietary habits that we have. So some activators of NRF2. So it gets active and it translocates, meaning it moves from the cytosol into the nucleus, where it will help the cell to activate certain genes that will detoxify the cell from these insults. So it will get rid of all the, it will detox in common words, it will do a detox of our cells from this oxidative stress.
So basically, NRF2 helps to reduce the amount of oxidative stress in our cells, right?
Exactly.
So, but how does one activate NRF2?
Well, there naturally? Are several natural products that are known to be activators of the NRF2 pathway. One of the most famous examples is sulforaphane, which is a natural product that can be found, for instance, in broccoli. Quercetin is another one that it's a compound that can be found in various fruits and vegetables. If we talk about Austrian fruits, we can find it in apples, for instance. And we have another example which could be famous as well, curcumin. I'm sure you already heard about curcumin that comes from the curcuma roots. And it activates also the NRF2 pathway. So if we have good and very... like a very mix of fruits and vegetables in our diets, we can have a lot of activators of NRF2.
So NRF2 seems to be really a pivotal protein when it comes to oxidative stress defense mechanisms. I wanted to ask you, how does this activity of NRF2 change as we age? So what happens when we age with NRF2?
Yes, actually, as we age, the expression of NRF2 decreases, losing its activity. That's why it's important that we have a variety of fruits and vegetables in our diet and a very healthy nutrition. And Agnes, I would like to talk to you about nutrition and its impact of aging. How pivotal is it in addressing age-related health challenges?
Nutrition plays a pivotal role. As you mentioned, Sarah, this is correct, because many older adults lack essential nutrients like protein even, or vitamin D. And when we talk about protein, protein is actually a critical nutrient that is necessary to preserve muscle mass and strength, which is necessary to keep people mobile when they are older. So, but the thing about muscle tissue is that it is actually composed or primarily composed of protein, and it undergoes continuous synthesis and breakdowns. Like 1-2% of the turnover rate of muscle tissue of the whole muscle tissue is turned over, which means that every 50 to 100 days your whole muscle mass is completely turned over. This means that there is a huge plasticity when it comes to muscle tissue, which makes the muscle tissue susceptible to muscle loss, especially during aging when there are some age-related illnesses, immobilities due to falls or fractures in older adults.
I see. But what drives muscle protein synthesis, actually?
Yeah, that is a very good question, Sarah. So muscle protein synthesis is stimulated by two factors. First is nutrition, because you need like the building blocks of proteins, which are the amino acids, which you consume via your diet. And the second is that you have to do some physical activity and to do some muscle contractions, which also plays a pivotal role, or a vital role, actually, to be able to maintain muscle mass and to optimize muscle growth.
Okay, but how does muscle maintenance differ when you're older and when you're younger?
Well, when you look at younger people, then you will see an increase of muscle mass, and it typically peaks around the age of 30. And after that, it gradually declines. So body composition changes, muscle mass declines. And by the age of 70, you can observe frequently that there is a decrease of 20% to up to 40% of muscle mass in older people. I mentioned sarcopenia before, which is the age-related loss of muscle mass. And there is a condition in older adults, which is called anabolic resistance. And this... as I've mentioned, there are two major stimuli for muscle, for the maintenance of muscle mass, which is on the one hand physical activity, and on the other hand nutrients, the consumption of essential amino acids. And in older adults, there is this issue that the muscle protein synthesis responds differently to those stimuli compared to younger adults. And there are also other factors that might enhance this fact, like physical activity, which can be observed more in older adults.
Thank you for that information. It's very useful, actually. I am just wondering, and maybe for our listeners, it's also important to know, what is the protein intake recommendation and what are good sources of protein?
Well, this can differ from society to society, but for German-speaking countries, for younger adults aged between 19 and 65 years, the recommendations are between approximately around 0.8 gram per kilogram body weight a day. However, in adults older than 65, it might be at least 1 gram per kilogram body weight a day, and other societies... different societies recommend different levels of protein intake. This can range from 1 to 1.5, 1.6 gram per kilogram body weight in day. And this can be really challenging for older adults to consume. And of course, this can be influenced if people try to add protein sources into every meal. And good protein sources can be lean meats, poultry, fish, dairy products, but there are also several excellent plant-based options like legumes, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, soy, or whole grains.
Okay, thank you. So I'm safe because as a Mexican, I consume a lot of legumes. But you mentioned that you also want to discuss a little bit about vitamin D. How prevalent is vitamin D deficiency?
Yeah, vitamin D deficiency is actually very, very common, especially in Europe. Vitamin D deficiency can be found in at least 40% of Europeans. And around 30% are experiencing severe vitamin D deficiency, especially Caucasian individuals living in regions with limited sunlight, and women are more affected and at higher risk to have or to suffer from vitamin D deficiency.
But what are the functions of vitamin D and what are the effects of its deficiency in older people?
Vitamin D is very, very well known to play an important role in bone health, but it exerts several other functions beyond this. It influences, for example, cell proliferation, cell differentiation. It has an effect on immune response regulation, because you can find vitamin D receptors in almost or nearly all cells in our bodies. And there are several physiological changes when it comes to vitamin D, such as the skin thickness is reduced in older adults. Also, a kidney function is declining. Also, the effects to certain hormones that are involved in the vitamin D pathways are reduced. This is the reason why older adults might lack vitamin D in general.
Yeah, but I have a question, and that might be really interesting for the population in general. So should we, an older individual especially, supplement with vitamin D?
Actually, this is also a very important point. it is not necessary to start a supplementation just because you believe that you have a vitamin D deficiency, because additional supplementation, when you have enough vitamin D levels in your plasma, won't bring you additional health effects. So without knowing your own plasma vitamin D status, it won't be... you cannot say for sure that you need vitamin D supplementation. And the thing is with vitamin D that our bodies are able to produce vitamin D on their own when UV radiation penetrates the skin, because there are precursor molecules of vitamin D that is activated through UV light, which then turns precursor molecules of vitamin D into... molecules that are then transformed by enzymes, specific enzymes, hydroxylases that can be found in the liver and kidney, into vitamin D, into its physiologically active form. And so it's not necessarily that you have to take supplements, because you can influence your vitamin D levels via exposing yourself to sunlight. And the recommendations are here between 10 to 15 minutes, around 10 to 15 minutes, your arms, you can expose your arms or parts of your skin to sunlight 3 times per week. And this should, of course, then enhance your vitamin D levels. But of course, you also have to consider that you shouldn't risk your skin gets burned.
Obviously,
because otherwise then the positive effects of vitamin D are outweighed by damage to your cells, which can, for example, cause DNA damage or something like this. So it is really essential to avoid sunburn.
Yeah, for sure. Got it. But what is your recommendation? Like, should we use sunblock? How frequently should we sunbathe? And how frequently should we reapply the sunscreen?
That is a very, very good question. So as I've mentioned, the recommendations, at least in our latitudes, have enough vitamin D levels is to go out into the sun for 10 to 15 minutes 3 times per week.
So we heard from Agnes a lot about vitamin D and protein consumption, and for me a little bit of how a mixed diet could benefit your antioxidant defense system.
Okay, so now we would like to move to the life part of this podcast. We would like to talk to you about a conference we just attended together with Sarah. Sarah, I have a question. Do you frequently attend conferences? And what are the things that you like the most, that you like least about conferences?
Well, I actually have the opportunity to attend to a lot of conferences during my PhD because I'm part of something called a Cost Action, which is a society within Europe that talks about NRF2. So that gives me the opportunity to visit a lot of places. Just this year alone, I was in London, Istanbul, and Krakow.
Wow.
Two of them were paid by the Cost Action. So that was really, really good. Both of them, London and Krakow, were training schools where I learned a little bit about NRF2, actually a lot, from PIs from different parts of Europe. So that was really
impressive.
Interesting.
It sounds really impressive. So for how long did you stay in these training schools?
It was just 1 week, but it was like a lot of things from 9 to 9, basically every day.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of new impressions or techniques did you learn? So,
well, from London, I talk a lot about hypoxia, which is like the cellular level of oxygen that we should have, which mm-hmm. is 5%. Which is should be called normoxia, but this is a different topic. And you ask what things I like the most and the least about conferences. And the things I like the least was all the preparation that you have to do before, because you have to prepare a talk, you have to prepare a poster, which mm-hmm. is a lot of work. And that is definitely my least favorite part. However, it all pays off at the end. Like when you go to the place, when you present your research, when you meet another scientist that works in the same field as you and you can share experiences, it's really, really valuable. So yes, it has some negative parts. Also the traveling can be really exhausting, but it really pays off.
So what kind of values are added when you're attending conferences besides just presenting something?
Well, you learn a lot about things that you cannot learn in the lab. So you learn about soft skills, for instance, because you cannot really like practice your networking skills in the lab. So you have to do it with international peers and so on and so forth. So this you can learn only in this environment. And also you learn a lot about different cultures because you get to see how people in other parts of the world do perform the research. And you also learn, again, this is very important, how to present in front of scientific audiences that are not your,
Supervisor, fellow peers.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's totally new people.
Your comfortable environment. Yeah, exactly. So you're outside of your bubble, of your comfort zone, yeah. And you get to present in front of complete new people, which is something that you don't have the opportunity to do every day. So I think it's very important. So Agnes and I were very fortunate to attend the annual conference for the Society for Free Radical Research in Istanbul recently. Agnes, what was your favorite part of the conference and what is your favorite part of Istanbul?
Well, this conference wasn't just about presenting our posters and our research, but it provided an excellent platform to hear top researchers in this field of redox biology. And Istanbul is actually a great city. It was really so rich in culture, and this totally added some new experiences when it comes to this conference. So it was really special.
Yeah, Agnes and I got the opportunity to travel a little bit, like just for one day around Istanbul. We saw the sightseeing. Right. We had good food. I don't know what you think, but the food was amazing.
The food was delicious. And also the people were very welcoming, and the hospitality was really exceptional. So it was really totally refreshing compared to the everyday academic setting in Vienna.
Yeah, for sure. I think what made the conference truly special was the interaction with other researchers, because we got the opportunity to network with other PhD and postdocs that are around our age that work in similar fields, and we were very close. So we were doing sightseeing together, we were going to have dinner together, we were going to have a drink afterwards together. So we were in a really special group, and we got to meet a lot of special people. Yeah.
Because this is not typical for every conference.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. I think the people in the Redox Biology Society are very welcoming.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. So because after we've listened to all these great talks and listened to these great researchers and scientists, the younger researchers, we stuck together and we did some activities, and we were a group of 30 young researchers who did some activities after these talks. And I think this is not typical for every conference. So this is really a nice experience. I think that we both are going to go next year also to the annual conference, which is going to take place in Galway, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, so me too.
Yeah, we will get the opportunity to see some of these people again and to interact with them again. So I'm really looking forward to that. Overall, Istanbul and the conference provided super valuable experiences for us as young researchers, and provide us with skills that otherwise we cannot achieve in any other way. So it's really important for PhDs and prospects PhDs to think that they should attend to at least one conference throughout the whole per year would be fantastic, at least one conference throughout the whole PhD would be really, really important.
Yeah, Sarah, I totally agree. So I think this is really key for every PhD student to get into interaction with other researchers who you're not familiar with, whom you can learn. So this is something we can really recommend to every PhD student.
Yeah. So let's wrap it up for this episode and give our concluding remarks. What are the key messages to our listeners for today? For me, it would be that NRF2 is a very important protein in our body, and we should consider to have a healthy and variety when it comes to our diet. So we can have natural products that naturally activate NRF2, and we have protection in our antioxidant defense system. What about you, Agnes?
Yeah, very important is to mention that when you get older, there are significant physiological changes, but this is not your destiny. So the loss of muscle mass is not your destiny. You can start training and improving your diets with more protein anytime, and you can increase or maintain muscle mass for longer and stay more active and healthier for a longer period of time, hopefully.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Life Sciences and Science Life. We are your hosts, Sarah
and Agnes. Tune in next month for more intriguing science topics, relatable PhD experiences, and experts' contributions on how to navigate the career path of a young scientist. The next episode is going to be about immigration, seen and unforeseen, with Lan, Andrea, and our own Sarah. This is a podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional, and Sports Sciences.
Don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn.
Thank you for listening. See you next time.